Good Friday afternoon. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Kentucky General Assembly just wrapped a short special session to address COVID-related issues. The Republican-dominated legislature banned mask mandates, but did push to move for incentives to improve the state's vaccination rate. Kentucky Public Radio Statehouse reporter Rylan Barton joins us now to talk about it all. Rylan, thank you for coming back on our show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be here.
They call these sessions extraordinary, and this truly was, as we still face this extraordinary pandemic. And we know that Governor Andy Beshear announced just a little bit ago that he's going to talk to the media at about 1 o'clock about the results of the special session. So let's just start with that. He seems like the big loser of this special session.
Yeah, and really that loss is handed to him by the legislature earlier this year. They passed several laws limiting his powers, and then the state Supreme Court issued a ruling more or less affirming those laws that that stripped the governor's powers. The most important of those is that his emergency orders only last for 30 days now unless the legislature renews them. So with a lot of emergency orders, including the state of emergency, set to expire, Beshear's hand was kind of forced in this case. He had to call the legislature in. And one of the first things they did was renew that state of emergency. And a lot of the kind of non-controversial emergency orders. But then, they had there were several other items on Beshear's agenda. And the legislature managed to kind of put their stamp on what they want the state's emergency response to look like going forward. And really the drum that they were beating was that they want more local control of some of these emergency measures, especially masking mandates. So the
I was curious about the mask mandate because we saw Governor Beshear lose in the courts when he issued a mask mandate for all schools in the state. He lost against the Diocese of Covington, a family from the Diocese of Covington, one of the schools in Northern Kentucky, and then overall. But the Kentucky Board of Education had also established a mask mandate for all public schools, which remained in effect even after the court stripped Beshear's executive order on masks. But now that one's gone too, right?
Right. And the Board of Education is slightly insulated from the governor's powers. They have their own emergency authority to do stuff like that. But the legislature can come in and go under the hood and change how those laws work. And that's exactly what they did. So local school districts will still be able to institute their mask mandates if they want to. I think you'll see probably JCPS, Louisville School District will go forward with that, maybe Lexington'sville as well, and a handful around the state. But before Beshear had instituted that mask mandate over the summer, 2/3 of Kentucky school districts were planning on making masks optional as the school year started. So I imagine we're going to have a lot of schools that do not go down that road.
No, it's interesting because here in Northern Kentucky, only 2 districts had mask mandates, Covington and Bellevue. The rest were allowing masks to be optional. But we just saw last week, ahead of the Labor Day weekend, the Diocese of Covington itself said, we will have a mask mandate when we return from the long holiday weekend, because that's when they had seen historically cases start to mount. So the Diocese of Covington has instituted a mask mandate after having its own families challenge the governor's order. I just saw moments before we went on the air, Dayton Independent Schools in Campbell County put a Facebook post up that they will maintain their mask mandate. But now this is going to be a piecemeal response, it looks like.
Yeah, and it'll be, the two options that schools have or kind of require masking or try to institute some of these mask quarantine policies, which have been happening a lot over the last month. That's been a real problem. It's thrown some smaller school districts into just totally closing down for several days, even weeks on end. That was another thing the legislature did, was try and provide a little bit more flexibility for some of these schools to go into remote learning. It's not a whole lot of flexibility. What it is 20 remote days for an entire district. And really how the legislature was envisioning this is that the district will be able to put individual schools or grades or even classes into quarantine. But again, they only have 20 of those discrete actions that they can use until the legislature comes back in January. So it's going to be interesting to see, especially some of these, some of these larger school districts, how they try to manage that, because the virus has really shown no sign of receding at this point. it's still escalating in Kentucky. And I think we're going to see a lot of schools, you know, having to start doing larger quarantines, and, you know, 20 days really might not end up being enough.
No, that's true, Rylan. It's a good point, because we are seeing escalating cases in younger people. We are seeing school districts forced to close already this early in the school year because of mounting COVID cases or exposures to COVID and required or necessary quarantines. I'm looking at the Kentucky High School Athletic Association football scoreboard. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are no scores yet. The games are tonight. But right now, it looks like there's about nearly a dozen games already canceled because of the COVID policy instituted by the KHSAA. What was the vocalized position of Republicans in looking at what is known about COVID cases in younger people, particularly in schools right now, before they made their move to remove masks from being mandated?
Well, I mean, as I'm sure everybody's familiar, a lot of the talking points really come down to that kids don't have a serious reactions to the virus, and so that they shouldn't really be subject to a lot of these mandates or closures or mask mandates. And really the next logical step to that, though, is that, well, still kids can transmit the virus, and really some kids do have very extreme reactions to them. We just don't, the argument doesn't often reach that level, that logical conclusion. And really, we're seeing the results of that, as we've been saying. Like, it leads to school closures, it leads to quarantines, because once the virus is on your doorstep or in your classroom or on your football team, everybody starts getting pretty scared and doesn't really want people to congregate anymore. The problem is that there's still just a lot of people who aren't taking it very seriously, who haven't gotten that message yet. And who really, like, a lot of people are still spreading a lot of misinformation on it. And you could see that in the legislature in spades over the last few days. A lot of lawmakers still expressing some conspiracy theories and misinformation about the virus.
We're talking with Kentucky Public Radio State House reporter Rylan Barton. Just out of curiosity, Rylan, were you inside the State House at all? Did you get a count on who was wearing masks, who wasn't? Was there a lot of mask wearing?
Yeah, I was in the Capitol, and there were a lot of people who were not wearing masks. There weren't a lot of members of the public. It was mostly just legislators and reporters and staff who were there. And really, as a reporter covering it, you can kind of like duck into a meeting, see what's going on, or see that there's a bunch of protesters on the steps and talk to a couple of people, and then I could duck back into my office. There are a lot of legislators in somewhat tightly congregated spaces, and a lot of people not wearing masks as well.
What about vaccines? What was the position on vaccines, or the talk of vaccines? I understand at one point there was talk of incentivizing vaccines again, particularly in schools.
Yeah, this is actually a bit of a division among Republicans in the legislature. A lot of the Republican leaders are really pushing for vaccines, encouraging people to get vaccinated. However, they really come up to this point where they say they do not want to mandate it. And so they're just kind of leaves this question. Oh, okay, well, how do you end up convincing a somewhat obstinate electorate to start getting vaccinated? And I think that some of those positions are slowly changing. Unfortunately, it really is because a lot of people are starting to have much more closer encounters with the virus, people having serious reactions to it, or knowing people who've died from it. But there are still some, I would say a vocal minority of legislators who are spreading conspiracy theories about the vaccine. And there's not a lot of tamping down of those arguments from Republican leadership. I think they just kind of are trying to, at least publicly there aren't. I think they're just trying to hope that a lot of that just gets swept up in the politics of it, and that they're able to kind of elevate the argument over it. However, I mean, that's really what's driving a lot of the resistance to any sort of coronavirus mandates in Kentucky.
There wasn't full approval of everything that was brought to the floor at the Capitol this week. Senate Joint Resolution Number 3, for example, Rylan, as you reported, it would have said that people who test positive for COVID antibodies will count as being fully vaccinated. Why didn't that move forward? That seems consistent with a lot of lawmakers' position.
Yeah, that popped up pretty late in the session, and really, it's something that's fueled by some new studies of people saying that people who have recovered naturally from coronavirus have better immunity than people who have gotten the vaccine. The CDC's position has been just the opposite, that people who are vaccinated are actually more than twice less as likely to get the virus as people who naturally recover from it. That passed out of the Senate. It was never taken up in the House. I don't know why that stopped, because I think that there is a lot of support for some of that. But I think that in the end, legislators kind of got wrapped up in covering some of the larger bills that were going forward. And they really wanted this session to wrap up quickly. They finished everything off in 3 days.
Yeah, they did move pretty quickly on all of this. There wasn't a lot of legislation to pass. There was only one non-COVID related piece of legislation. This is an investment to incentivize businesses to come to the state. Can you tell us a bit about this $410 million?
Yeah. So it's $410 million that comes out of the state's rainy day fund, and it's supposed to create some incentives to attract large businesses. So businesses that are looking to invest more than $2 billion in Kentucky. There's actually one specific site that is mentioned in this. It's a site in Hardin County near Elizabethtown. The state had actually bought this land back in 2002 when they were trying to attract Hyundai to move to Kentucky, but Hyundai ended up building a factory in Alabama instead. So yeah, they're trying to get somebody to fill this site or something. But legislators and Governor Beshear's administration is also supporting this. They've been pretty tight-lipped on who this is going towards. They do say that there are at least five companies that are interested in making an investment this large. Whenever you hear state money going towards an anonymous company in Kentucky, everybody thinks of Brady Industries, the defunct project. Well, I guess they're still trying in northeastern Kentucky to build an aluminum plant near Ashland. That happened under Governor Matt Bevin's administration, and the state set aside $15 million for that without knowing what the project would be. And, you know, it's kind of a black eye on the state's economic development strategy, because it really just hasn't come to fruition yet.
In our last 30 seconds together, Ryland, I suppose that now the legislature, dominated by Republicans, has had its say on COVID. Governor Beshear had his say. They were always at odds. But now this appears to be where we are and how Kentucky is officially going to be dealing with the pandemic moving forward. Is that right? I mean, what could possibly happen next to change things at the state level?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the next thing to watch for is if the virus continues to escalate. You know, the governor's emergency orders do last for 30 days. He could come and try to do something else. Then again, he could call the legislature in for another special session to try and deal with some new stuff. One thing legislators really wanted was for Beshear to set aside more money for to attract and retain healthcare workers in Kentucky, because there's just a real strain on hospital staff and space right now, and they're hoping to keep more healthcare workers in the state.
Kentucky Public Radio State House reporter Ryland Barton. Ryland, thanks so much for the hard work you did all week and then spending some time with us on this Friday.
Nice to talk to you, Michael.
Up next, Kroger stock takes a big jump. We'll talk about why that may be. We look at how local people are remembering 9/11 on this 20th anniversary, and a preview of the Bengals season, which kicks off Sunday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with Business Courier reporter Steve Watkins. Steve, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
It's always our pleasure to have you, Steve. And you had a bunch of stories about Kroger this week. And we'll start with their stock situation. It was some report related to Costco that apparently benefited Kroger stockholders. And then you told me before we went on the air that perhaps the stock took a little bit of a dip today. So help me understand.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a roller coaster ride for Kroger, and a busy week for them too. Absolutely. So we'll start with the first thing you mentioned. About a week ago, Kroger stock hit an all-time high. And one of the things that analysts think prompted it was that Costco, the big shopping club, supermarket club, posted August sales results that were very strong. So on one hand, you might think, well, they're a rival of Kroger. If they were strong, how does it help Kroger? But the point wasn't that Costco was taking market share from Kroger necessarily, but that more shoppers were going to supermarkets rather than eating out. And this trend was going to help all of the supermarkets, Kroger being the largest pure supermarket play company in the country. It stands to benefit as much as anybody. So the stock hit an all-time high. Now today, this morning, Kroger posted their second quarter earnings. And a little bit of a paradox there, too, where Kroger's earnings beat analyst expectations. They were down a little bit, but you have to remember that a year ago, people were shopping at grocery stores all the time and not eating out very much at all. That's changed some, clearly, by now. But Kroger's results beat what analysts expected. Kroger even raised their future outlook expectations, yet the stock is down 7% today at this point. So why is that? Well, a couple of things. Analysts thought they might raise their guidance for the future even more. And they also wanted to see a little bit more strong sign that Kroger was going to buy back stock, which helps the existing shareholders. So a couple of things analysts were looking for. Also, as we mentioned, the stock just hit an all-time high last week, so there wasn't a lot more room for it to rise, and almost anything that anybody could perceive as slightly negative was going to hurt the stock.
Well, Steve, you also reported this week that Kroger is seeing its traffic, its customer traffic, slow a bit in recent months, and that there's a possibility that it could slow even further. Obviously, we know early in the pandemic, we all basically lived at Kroger as quickly as we could get in and out of there, but you weren't going anywhere else except the grocery store. And so then the pandemic eased a bit, and now the pandemic seems like the worst it's been in a lot of data points, but that has not helped Kroger again.
Well, it hasn't in the sense of a number of customer visits, but that was a trend that we saw last year too. So you're right that the pandemic is getting worse. And what happened last year when the pandemic was bad is people spent way more than they usually do at Kroger and at other grocery stores, but their number of visits went down. People wanted to go, I'm just going to go once a week or even every other week. I don't want to be out in the public as much. And so they'd stock up all at once. And that's what was happening last year. And it might be what's starting to happen this year, because the analysts I talked to were not very concerned about that trend. They said, well, traffic might be down a little bit, but there are other things that matter a lot more, including the amount per visit that customers are spending. And that's still pretty strong. And Kroger's market share, that's the other key. Kroger's market share remains really strong. In fact, in Cincinnati, it's nearly 50%. And they're in the top two in most, if not all, of their major markets.
What are other large grocery chains seeing as it relates to customer traffic trends? I know you mentioned Albertsons and Publix, for example, in one of your pieces.
Yeah, well, and they're kind of seeing the same thing. And what's happening, this is the other thing we should point out, or I should point out, is Kroger, Albertsons, Publix, all of these big supermarket operators, their customer traffic is up significantly from a year ago. So that is one aspect of it. It's just that back in May and June, it was up even more from that same point last year. So it's drifting down, but it's not plummeting. And so that, I think that's why analysts see this as not a major concern in terms of the amount of business that Kroger and the others are doing.
We're talking with Steve Watkins, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. And Steve, we just mentioned Publix, and they're moving into Kentucky. They're about to open, apparently, the first location in the state in Louisville. And what does that mean for Kroger? Because Louisville's another strong market for Kroger.
Yeah, that's a really interesting development, because Publix is big in the Southeast. They're based in Florida. About two-thirds of their stores, they have about 1,200 stores. By comparison, Kroger has more than 2,700, so about twice as many. But Publix, about two-thirds of their stores are in Florida, and Kroger doesn't really have stores in Florida. They've got one right by the border of Georgia, and that's all. So for the most part, and Publix is a very strong operator, I should add, in Florida, and wherever they operate, they're known as being real strong. But Kroger and Publix don't compete in a lot of places. They do in Atlanta, some other markets in the Southeast, like North Carolina, but not in a lot of places that Kroger operates. But now Publix is going into, I think it's just the eighth or ninth state that they operate in, and that being Kentucky, and their first location there is, it will be in Louisville, where Kroger is very strong, about as strong as they are in Cincinnati. Kroger has just about 50% of the grocery market there. So some people see it as maybe a sign that Publix is trying to go after Kroger a little bit and go into its stronghold markets. And it's possible they could even come up here into Northern Kentucky and maybe even in, onto the Ohio side.
That will be interesting to watch. I know everyone loves to hear news about grocery stores. I don't know why that's so popular with people, but people do love grocery store news. And that's why we're talking about it today. And so I'm wondering, what do we know? I know you talked to an advisor at one of these investment firms here in town about how Publix competes with Kroger in other markets where they do overlap.
Yeah. One of the investment advisors told me is that Publix is a very strong competitor. But the idea seems to be in the analyst size that Publix and Kroger can both remain strong, even if they're competing in the same market. And it's more likely that both will take market share away. This is a trend that's been going on for a while. Take market share away from some of the smaller and weaker competitors. So it's sort of a case of the strong getting stronger more than one of the strong knocking down the other.
Steve, you often report on the overlap of business and sports. And I don't know if you carved that niche out yourself when you were negotiating your job over there at the Business Courier, but you've gotten...
I certainly should have. It's been so long ago, I can't remember how that developed, but either I did that, or I think more or less people just saw that I was such a big sports person that it made sense for me to do it.
Well, I'm glad they did, because I enjoy talking about this with you as well. And you've got some coverage of the University of Cincinnati's athletics program moving into the Big 12 Conference. And even if you're not a sports fan of the local colleges, why does it matter the caliber of the conference as it relates to the university overall?
Well, it's a huge deal. And by the way, this became more or less official today. The Big 12 said they would inviting UC and three other schools to the Big 12. It's a huge deal for a few reasons. One of the main ones is what makes anything a big deal, which is money. And by joining the Big 12, it remains to be seen a little bit, but based on the amount of money that each school in the Big 12 has shared in the past, and 2019 is the best example because 2020, as we know, COVID shortened the football season and everything else. If you look at 2019, teams in the Big 12 each received about $40 million from the conference. Now, Texas and Oklahoma are leaving. And that's why the Big 12 is expanding. And those two generated a lot of that money. But the Big 12's commissioner said their departure will probably cost each school about $14 million. That still leaves $26 million per school that UC can sort of expect. There could be some differences depending on how they treat new schools such as UC immediately when they join. But just using that $26 million figure as an example, UC right now shares or receives from the American Athletic Conference about $6 million. So you're talking about a fourfold increase just in their revenue. So as you asked, now that helps the athletic department. What does it do for the school as a whole? Well, it puts it on a much bigger stage, certainly athletically. But you see schools that are playing in, for example, the college football playoff, which is right now only four teams. UC almost got in there last year. As a member of the Big 12, they'd have a much better chance of getting in there. And you get that kind of exposure nationally. It does wonders for admissions and things like that. Donations from alumni go up. There's a lot of examples of that where the impact is felt across the university, the athletic department probably being the biggest recipient, but across the university, it's a huge impact.
And we should note that West Virginia is a member of the Big 12, so Bob Huggins fans still here in Cincinnati might get the opportunity to see the Mountaineers and the Bearcats on the basketball court.
Great point, yeah.
And the conference itself, though, is centralized primarily in the Plains States. So does that matter to UC? West Virginia would be the farthest east, and then Cincinnati and the rest. I mean, we're talking about Texas schools, a school in Iowa, Iowa State, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. And so what does that mean for, I don't know, travel expenses? Or is this an area where they would be able to get a recruiting footprint that might be important to their athletics programs?
Yeah, well, it's a good question and a great point. This is what happens when these big conferences realign, as they've been doing for off and on, probably the last 20 years or more. But the footprint does change a lot. And UC is, as you pointed out, kind of on the fringes geographically of the Big 12. So it's great in terms of revenue and exposure, but also, you know, for any sport, but probably more noticeably for the non-revenue sports, such as, you know, track and field, you know, volleyball, things like that. There's talk they might add softball. You know, for sports like that, that don't have as big of a budget as, let's say, the football or basketball program, if they're traveling to Texas or even Iowa or Oklahoma for games, those are long trips. They're probably driving most of the time, you know, so there is definitely a bigger expense involved in that. It's clearly more than offset by the increase in revenue. But yeah, as players and, you know, having your parents come to a road game, for example, it's going to be a lot tougher.
Steve Watkins is a reporter with the Cincinnati Business Courier. Steve, thanks for spending some part of your Friday with us, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Absolutely. You too, Michael. Thanks for having me.
You got it. And now, it's been 20 years since the 9/11 terrorist attack in this country, and WVXU's Julian Almendarez joins us now with how historical events are remembered or not remembered. Julian, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on today, Michael.
Your story is live now, WVXU.org. And in this story, Julian, you talk to a variety of age groups. And what struck you as you talked to these different age groups about these types of events like 9/11?
Gosh, so I'm going to start with Walter Oka. He's a man who is in his 90s. He watched Pearl Harbor get bombed from his porch. His family lived on a bluff nearby. So he watched this happen. He was 13 years old. He watched his brothers go off to war. And what struck me as we were having conversations, as we were poring over these photo albums he has meticulously kept over the years, is that he remembers everything with such great detail. He can tell me about looking up and seeing the Japanese flag on the planes. His details are so crisp, you know? And then I move on and I talk to another man who was in DC when the Pentagon was hit by a plane on September 11th. And he just, the exact same thing. He can talk to me about just like exactly what it looked like, exactly what it felt like, what happened inside the hotel he was at, and what he saw on the way out. And his name's Ron Richards. He lives right here in Cincinnati. And again, it's an experience where it's emotional, it's visceral. And then we move on to some teenagers. And I want to be clear, they're very smart teenagers that I spoke to right down the street from Newport High School. And it's strange to hear them talk about 9/11 because, yeah, they know the facts. They know what happened that day. But they don't have this like visceral memory. They don't have an emotional connection. So the things that like you and I remember as being so scary or so uncertain that day just misses the next generation. And so I really explored how these different events just kind of change as they're retold throughout the years.
Well, it's interesting reading this because when you get to the part, if you're someone who lived through the experience of 9/11 and watching it unfold live, and you read about teenagers not having any reference, at least not a similar reference, it doesn't seem that much different than when I'm reading about the gentleman you mentioned before, Walter Aka, who lived through Pearl Harbor. I know what Pearl Harbor was. I know when it happened. But I don't have that kind of visceral memory that's connected to it. Neither would you, of course. So talk a bit about these teenagers, because that's what I found the most interesting, because 9/11 and perhaps this pandemic are the most significant events in American history during my lifetime. But what are their views of it?
Right. So this was really fascinating. You know, there are two teens who know, like, yeah, this thing happened and it was really important and it's really sad. And one of them had even gone to the 9/11 museum this summer, saw the fountain, saw the photos of the first responders who died saving lives. They understand this is historical. This is important. But to hear them talk about it, it's almost like a book report. You know what I mean? They don't really have that reaction. And so talk about things that didn't make the story, right? So I asked them, you know, for your lifetime, the event you may end up telling your grandkids someday would be COVID. You know, what would that be like? And then they kind of like launched into their experiences with COVID, which is so much more personal. One of them, like, her dad had COVID, and she talked about like the family's faith in prayer and how they were so scared during that time period. And it's a totally different kind of reaction from them. And I just thought it was fascinating to compare the two.
I suppose reading your reporting, one of the fears from people who experienced an historic event and want future generations to know about it, Walter Aka himself says that he does believe that history gets a little glossed over by later generations, right?
Exactly. And I think it's fascinating for him to say that, because when I say he has photos, I mean, he has stacks of photo albums, and with very clear memory was said, this is my brother. I took this in this part of Japan. This is my friend so-and-so, and can go through and really point out these specific things. And he was, you know, and he told me, I had my kids go to Hawaii and Japan, my grandkids. He has these beautiful photos of his grandkids in the same place, like taking pictures in the same places where he was when he was in Japan many years ago. And, you know, showing this to me, and I asked him, like, well, do they understand? Do they really get exactly like what you went through? And he was Japanese at the time of
the war.
I've got
about 10 seconds.
And they really, he tells me they really don't, that they really can't grasp it because they just weren't there.
Read this story at WVXU.org. Jolene Almendarez, thanks for your time.
Thanks for giving me so much of it, Michael.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with a look ahead to the Cincinnati Bengals season, which starts this weekend against the Vikings. And joining us now is Inquirer Bengals beat reporter Kelsey Conway, who I spoke with earlier this morning. She's on the practice field or near the practice field, headed to the practice field. Kelsey, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Yeah, that's usually where you'll find me these days. But thanks so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking some Bengals football with you.
Well, we're all excited. I'm mostly excited because I know that Bengals football means autumn and sweater season. But I'm also a passive Bengals fan. I hope they win. How do they look?
They look really good heading into this season. And I think the biggest thing that people should know is when you get through a training camp in preseason, the biggest goal you want to accomplish, of course, is getting your team ready, but coming out healthy. The Bengals really only suffered one significant injury to a player who could be a starter, and that was rookie Joseph Osai. But from a health standpoint, the team is checking out great, and that's the main goal, because there's a lot of teams recently around the NFL that have lost 2 to 3 starters before they've even played a game that matters. So that's important to know about the Bengals. But from an offensive standpoint, Joe Burrow looks like he's even more confident than he was. He expects to be better this year. It took him a little bit to get adjusted the first week of training camp practice. He said he really wasn't himself until about the second week. but I saw him make a number of plays that showed, you know, that he's not thinking about his knee injury. Of course, he is playing in a knee brace, but
I wanted to ask about Joe Burrow. Of course, he's the quarterback, and so all eyes are on Joe Burrow. His rookie season was cut somewhat short after that injury. Health-wise, he seems to be okay?
Yes, he is all systems go. The Bengals let him take 3 snaps in the final preseason game just so he could kind of get dressed, go out there with his teammates, make a few play calls in the huddle just so that it's not startling for him when he gets out there on Sunday for the first time when the Bengals play the Vikings. That was important to him, and that was important to Zach Taylor. But from a health standpoint, Joe looks great. He's confident, and he expects to be even better this year, which is a very good thing for the Bengals, because before Joe Burrow got hurt, he was on pace to break a number of rookie records. So they've got their franchise guy at quarterback now in Joe Burrow.
I was going to say he looks good too. I was watching some of the videos from his press conference that you shared on Twitter at Kelsey L. Conway, and I thought, man, the guy looks he looks a year older, and he looks cleaned up and ready to go.
Yeah, he's, for only being 24, and I've covered a number of very polished players in my time, he is about as professional and confident as they come. And I think for him to be that way so young in his career just really shows how special he really can be in the city of Cincinnati. And I know playing here and being the quarterback here means a lot to him. So I think Joe Burrow is going to have a big year. The big thing for him will be, can the offensive line protect him and keep him healthy?
And we're talking with Kelsey Conway, the Cincinnati Inquirer Bengals beat reporter, ahead of this Sunday's opening season game for the Bengals. They're taking on the Vikings. What do we know about the Vikings? How do we expect this game to go?
Expect this game to be an interesting one because the teams are kind of similar. The Vikings made the playoffs 2 years ago. They had lost that crazy game against the New Orleans Saints. But the Vikings are coached by Mike Zimmer, who, if you follow the Bengals closely, yeah, you will remember that name. He was a longtime defensive coordinator here. He's very well-liked within the building in Cincinnati. But they've got one of the best running backs in the NFL in Dalvin Cook. He's a top 3 running back. Kirk Cousins is consistent, but on defense, they went under a significant amount of turnover in terms of they were really bad last year, and Mike Zimmer wanted to add more pieces. But from a talent and roster evaluation standpoint, I would say these teams are pretty evenly matched. I'd actually give an edge to the Bengals, especially on offense, because of Joe Burrow. I think he's more dangerous than Kirk Cousins, but I think there's some really good players. Justin Jefferson, the Vikings wide receiver, was the best rookie wide receiver in the NFL last year. He's very good friends with Ja'Marr Chase and Joe Burrow. They were all part of that 2019 LSU National Championship team together. And then on defense, the Vikings have a couple key players up front: Danielle Hunter, Patrick Peterson, veteran quarterback. But it's a matchup that I think the teams are pretty evenly matched, which I think will make for a pretty close game, which that's what you want in a week 1 matchup. You don't want to see a blowout as a fan, right? You want to see a close game.
You want to welcome football back with some excitement, and you, especially if you're a Bengals fan, want to welcome it back with a win. What do you think the mental impact is on the organization and fans with a victory, I should say? I want to be optimistic here.
Well, I think every team in the NFL is trying to get their season off to a good start with a win. But I think especially in Cincinnati, with all of the changes they've made to the game day environment, Joe Burrow being back healthy, especially Joe Mixon as well. He missed a number of games last year. I think there's a lot of energy around the Bengals right now, more so than any years past. And I think if you're able to get off to a 1-0 start, it's just going to make it even more interesting. And I really do think the Bengals' first 3 games are winnable games for the team. And if you're able to start the season, let's say 3-0, you're looking a lot. Things are going to be a lot different in Cincinnati than we've seen in the years past, in a good way.
All right. Well, I'm going to trust you on that. But you just mentioned that there is
got to start with the Vikings.
Exactly. One game at a time. You mentioned some changes to the fan experience, and I want to get into that with you. But the first most noticeable thing for those of us who might be watching on television this Sunday is that there's going to be new uniforms. And we did see these earlier in the summer, and I think they look pretty cool.
Yeah, the Bengals will be in their all-white new uniforms. The jerseys they look so crisp and clean, and we were able to see them on Sunday when they played that final preseason game against Dolphins. But they're going to be in their new all-white jerseys, which have been very popular with the fans. They've made a number of changes in terms of pre-game activity. So they're going to have this ceremony called the Ruler of the Jungle, where they're going to pick a special person to the organization, whether it's a player, person, fan, where they're going to kind of get the fans in their seats early and start the Houdet chant, things like that. So they're kind of token of getting people in the building. And then they've added a number of changes to their player introductions in terms of fire-breathing tigers for the players to come through the tunnel to. They've made a section in the 300 level called what they're calling the Canopy Crazies, where if you get a ticket to be up there, they want to make it kind of like a college student section. So if you're looking for kind of more of a crazy game day environment, they're going to have that for you. They've really dedicated a lot of their resources this offseason to making a better game environment. And Sunday's the first day they're going to be able to show it off.
Yeah, it's going to be a great environment. I bet people have been longing for this. Are they expecting a good crowd?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, Zach Taylor has repeatedly said just how much not having fans last year made them not appreciate fans more, but it makes a difference when there's fans in the stands. And that was so notable to coaches and players last year that the desire to get the fans in the stands is almost even more from the players and coaches because they truly view the fans as a way to help them win. If you can create a great home field environment, I mean, look at so many teams in the NFL, whether it's the Chiefs, the Saints, some of those crowds are crazy, and it truly makes it difficult on the opposing team to execute their plays, to be able to hear one another talk. And Zach, Joe Burrow, Joe Mixon have said they're ready to put this city on their back. They're ready to give the fans what they want and what they deserve. And I think that all starts with getting fans in the stadium to be there, and you got to give the fans something to cheer for, and the Bengals really want to be able to do that this year.
We're talking with Kelsey Conway, the Cincinnati Inquirer Bengals beat reporter. Kelsey, you and your colleague Charlie Goldsmith over at the Inquirer, I believe Charlie's been on the program before as well. You guys went through the whole season and made some predictions, and I want to note that just moments ago you talked about how important it could be to the morale and the expectations of the season if the Bengals could start 3-0. You do pick the Bengals to beat the Vikings on Sunday. You also pick the Bengals to win at Chicago on the 19th. But here's where it gets a little tricky. The third game, you predict the Steelers are going to beat the Bengals, and you know what that must mean to Bengals fans.
Yeah, it's nothing against the Bengals. It's just the Steelers have outmatched the Bengals for the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's been bad.
And I just think that the Steelers' defense is just so good, and I think they know how to scheme against the Bengals. I think it's going to be a really close game, and it wouldn't shock me if the Bengals split the series with the Steelers at one point, but Heinz Field is such a hard place to play. I was just talking about home field environment. It's such a hard place to play. Their fans are insane. They show up hours before the kick, the terrible towels and everything. That's more so about being an away team versus I don't think the Bengals can hang. I do think they have the players to hang with teams like the Steelers and the Ravens and the Browns now, but I think just the home field advantage the Steelers have is going to make it difficult.
Well, I should say to your credit, by week 12, when the Steelers come to Cincinnati, you do pick the Bengals to win by then. So maybe they take a bad loss or something early on, and then they get their revenge later. So are we a playoff team this year?
It's way too early to tell. I would be crazy to try and predict that right now. You think that if they're able to get 9 wins, they're going to be in the conversation. And the Ravens suffered pretty significant injuries to a couple of their key starters this week. And I think that is going to be a really tough pill for them to swallow. So right now, I'd actually probably take the Bengals ahead of the Ravens in the division, which I didn't when I was making my predictions. But that just goes to show things can change so quickly in the NFL. But I do think that the Bengals, Joe Burrow guarantees you at least six wins, in my opinion. Zach Taylor had a great quote when I was interviewing him for an article on Cincinnati.com that I encourage Bengals fans to check out about his expectations and how he deals with pressure. He said, there's a belief every time Joe Burrow walks on the field that we have a chance. And he's got so much talent, and the Bengals have so much talent at receiver and running back that I think that automatically gives them some games. They just need to be better on defense, and they need to protect Joe Burrow better. If they're able to do that, and they're able to get to 9 wins, then you can start talking about, do they have a chance of the postseason? But if you get off to an 0-4 start, or, you know, things aren't looking great, then you got another problem to talk about. But I think if they're able to get off to a good start and, you know, kind of win that Thursday night game, the primetime game against the Jags, and let's say they're 3-1 or perhaps 4-0, then you can really start saying, okay, I think this team might have a shot, but just too early to tell. You got to see them take a snap of regular season football before you can put that kind of prediction out there.
Well, Kelsey, you've been very generous with your time, but if you don't mind, I just got one more just journalist-to-journalist question. You're new to the Bengals beat for the Inquirer. I'm wondering, what are you excited about on this beat, or what is challenging for you on this beat? You know how Bengals fans can be as soon as their hearts get broken again.
I absolutely have enjoyed every moment that since I've taken this job with the Inquirer. Just the passion from the readers and the fans, and that's why I'm not really fazed when people are upset about their team or they tweet at me that they're upset, you know, things like that. I got into this because I love sports and I love passionate fans. And at the Inquirer, there's just such a appreciation for the fact that the Inquirer is the lead newspaper in the city and people care. And I love being able to connect fans to their favorite teams through articles, podcasts, videos, however I can help connect fans and make them feel closer to their team and feel like they learned something every time they read something or listened to Charlie and my podcast. That's what I love. So working for the Inquirer has been absolutely great. I'm so excited to be here. I hope that all the Bengals fans are able to check out our content on Cincinnati.com. We have so many good things planned coming, and I'm really excited to be here and appreciative of everyone who's read, subscribed, and listened and watched our content so far. It's only going to get better.
Kelsey Conway is the Cincinnati Inquirer Bengals beat reporter. A lot of content already in a short period of time. We'll look forward to following it all season long. Kelsey, thanks so much for the time you gave us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on. Talk with you soon.
You got it. And again, the Cincinnati Bengals host the Minnesota Vikings on Sunday at Paul Brown Stadium. It's a 1 p.m. game. What a great way to end a weekend. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. Hope you have a great weekend. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Monday.